Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. And, sorry, I called in a little late here. Hang on one second. I was going to, I have a caller on the line here. I just want to see what's... good evening. Can I, caller? 401?
Hey, hello. I'm just listening. I don't have the internet, so if that's all right, I'll just listen online.
Sure, that's okay. I'll just hang in there, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Tonight, I'm going to do, I was going to do a segment on spirituality and so on, but my new publisher decided that this... one of my chapters in my book, Naked at the Mic, The Survival of the Liberal in a Time of Peril, he thought it was a little too radical and wanted to take it out of the new revised edition, updated edition of the book. And I agreed to let him do that, but at the same time, I wanted to make sure that I have it's a short article, it's a short chapter, chapter 10. I wanted to make sure that I read it and had it recorded in my archives. I've read a number of the chapters of this book, but tonight I want to do this one since it won't be in the updated version. In chapter 10 of the book, it's called "The Creation of the Radical Underground." And I thought it might be appropriate tonight because of the tremendous riots going on in, around the Middle East. And it might be appropriate, even though Volosher thought it was pretty inflammatory. But I felt that it was important because it was an important chapter in the sense that it talks about the creation of a radical underground in the United States. Then I'll begin. It's pretty self-explanatory. No one has to worry about who or what or where the underground is, because it is already there. The radical underground is already in place and has been for years. The only problem is so few people know about it. I'm writing about it, but even I don't know who or what or where it is. And for all practical purposes, I don't want to know. I only want to see the effect of its actions. The mistake of many liberal movements have made in the past is they identify a leader and announce their intentions to the world. Hey, hey, ho, ho, George W. Bush has got to go. The smart radical stays quiet and hits where it hurts. He organizes boycotts, parades down Main Street, stops traffic on Wall Street, but work quietly until the day comes. Don't be stupid and apply for permits. Odds are if officials know what the demonstration or parade is for, they'll deny the permit anyway. Big planned rallies get little attention. It's the big unplanned rallies that get the attention. Remember the anti-WTO rally in Seattle? That shook up a whole lot of people in the media for several years. Don't give out your name. Use code words. Organize quietly but effectively. Use stealth as your weapon. Keep your strategy secret until you are ready to implement it, and then tell those who will help you. Refuse to give any information about your political leanings over the phone or in person. Don't give any information to political party pollsters, or if you must tell them something, tell them you support all conservative incumbents. Tell them the exact opposite of what you really think. If enough of us stay silent until we act, this will screw up pollsters and campaign strategists around the country. If a radical were to agree with a right-winger, regardless how outrageously insane their statements are, And when it comes time to vote on an issue or debate an issue, the right will have absolutely no clue as to what the left's real intentions or who the left really are. Our leaders are ourselves. Our actions are individual. But we know through our secret friendships what is really happening in the movement. Radicals have to stop wearing their hearts on their sleeves and keep a poker face about what they plan to do. If you announce to the world via bullhorn and internet that you're going to have a big march on D.C. or such and such on such and such a day at such and such a time, and tell the whole damn world, you can be certain that the NSA and the KKK and the FBIs of the world will find out and try to screw it all up. If we do have a grand protest somewhere, let it not be announced publicly until it happens. Let it be a surprise to everyone except all who intend. They can't arrest 100,000 people or 500,000 people who show up in a city unannounced. They can't arrest any leaders that they can't identify, especially if everyone claims to be just a sightseer. Liberals have got to learn to be discreet. Do as the Masons have done for the last 10 centuries. Use a system of handshakes and secret signs known only to radicals. Liberals must create secret underground codes to speak to each other, and all must be done face-to-face. No cell phone calls, no emails, no websites, no Facebook or MySpace or Twitter notices unless they are in code. No large, unexplainable gatherings where you know Big Brother will be watching or become suspicious, unless it's a concert or some commercially sponsored event. Let the conservatives and corporations and government sponsor events and spend their money to support our gatherings. Then when radicals show up with tickets, we're going to stop us from talking to each other, or we pretend to listen to Donny Osmond or Barry Manilow. We can always support our bands and favorite artists by buying their CDs and attending their concerts. But if we really want to mess up the system, let's support some of the strangest conservative singers. What an insult it would be to pay for a performance by Lee Greenwood or Hank Williams Jr. and everyone in the audience is listening to his own iPod or CD player and completely ignoring the stage. It would be a real quiet riot. Let them make money, which is all the sponsors and organizers really care about, and have a great time ignoring the acts on stage while talking to your radical friends. All the time being polite to police and not causing any trouble. Try to discourage excessive drinks or drugs. Have an after-concert party. It is a put-down protest without any shouting, simply ignoring. Pay to ignore. Pick one concert a year of the most horrible, outspoken, popular right-wing songster in the country and make it a sellout crowd for a radical convention. You could buy out hundreds of tickets and scalp them online through a liberal website. It would blow the right-wing mind into early dementia. Even greater would be for someone with serious money to buy up a complete sellout concert and demand the singers perform to an empty stadium. Liberals rise and fight the conservative consciousness that is corrupting our country and world. What is the radical underground? Who are its members? How can they be identified? These are the questions that would be asked by the NSA Radical Underground Task Force. Radicals are untraceable, yet are everywhere and nowhere. Radicals are invisible, yet taking over the country, but can't be seen or heard or recognized. Every radical brought in for questioning would swear a loyalty oath to whatever sellout is in office. It wouldn't mean shit, just like G.W. Bush's presidency didn't mean shit. No. No one would know who was a radical or who wasn't. Every conservative in the country would start distrusting his own family members and friends. Only radicals would know who they were. Symbols and signs would appear everywhere, but only a member of the radical underground would be able to identify them. Gangs do it all the time. Masons and other secret societies do it constantly. Radicals must do it as well. Radicals start to dress like rednecks. It will force a redneck to wear a suit and tie or stop the war t-shirt. Wear a caterpillar hat or a hat with I Love America on it. I promise you, we'll become invisible. And that is exactly what you want to be. Take on a pseudonym, like Red Dog or Mad Cat or Big Boy or Bush's Bastard. Or if you are a woman, go by Bush's Bitch or Newt's Nancy or Billy Bob's Bushy Babe. These are all right-wing redneck nicknames. Start a blog with these names and think of the most sickening sweet sarcasm you can think of for a defense of Bush and the neocons when they and all their Republican cronies are finally indicted for war crimes and treason. If radicals did this, then anything complimentary said about Bush or his henchmen or conservatives would be considered a put-down. Anything bad said about them would be considered a compliment. This could force a Fox News anchor person to say that George W. Bush or Dick Cheney is a despicable human being, and this would be considered a compliment to them by Fox viewers. Imagine if any Fox News or other network news anchor gave a compliment to the Bush administration's handling of an issue, and their viewers considered it as an insult to them or the magnificent former leader. G.W. Bush and all of his cronies will soon be before the courts and congressional hearings for criminal investigations. So now is the time for all of us to remember how much we like what G.W. did during his two terms in office. This would cause perfect pandemonium. A liberal would have a smile on his face every single minute of the day, knowing that he was totally screwing up the conservative brain with pure, sweet, and sincere-sounding sarcasm. If the conservatives caught on to the game in a few years from now, they would have to dress and act like old liberals, like an old liberal to counterattack us. Then, we could go back to our old ways and enjoy the rest of our lives, having reclaimed liberalism for America and the world, and the conservatives would be completely baffled. We just keep our clothing for a few more years until we come back into fashion, either right-wing or left. A good caterpillar hat lasts 10 years. The older it looks, the more authentic you will look. The war of the intellect is what the liberal must win. The war of violence and bloodshed will always be won by the barbarian. War will continue and will always be won by those who employ the most ruthless and cruel methods that create the most bloodshed. The way of the intellectual, the way of the diplomat, the way of the courts, these are the ways that all conflicts should be settled. Death, destruction, and human misery are the ways of the wicked, the murderer, the idiot, the barbarian, and the cannibal. Any real liberal or rational individual is far better than that and far too intelligent than to wade in the primordial ooze of barbaric reasoning. And I refer everyone to my essay on conservatives in the essay book, in the essay section of this book. that chapter will be deleted. This book now is available on Amazon.com, but the new version will be as well. But I've agreed to allow that essay, that chapter, to be edited, deleted from the book, and for the new one, since the publisher was a little concerned that it might inspire riots and so on. But, you know, you have to take it with a grain of salt, because basically what it is. And I have always advocated dissent when things are wrong. And if I don't agree with them, I have to speak out. I think that's important for everybody to do that. It's part of my nature, and it's part of everyone's, essentially everyone's nature to speak out against what they don't agree with. And for that reason, and that reason alone, I'm going to read this article, or this essay. It's called The Radical Soul. And I've read this several times on the show, but I still keep going back to it only because I like it. And I wrote it on December 4th, 2004. And all of my essays in this book are dated, so people can see, get the historical perspective of what I was thinking of and what was going on in society in our the country at the time. Something makes a radical radical. I haven't identified that certain attribute or detriment to the radical character yet. As I keep seeing more injustice and abuse of power and starving, crippled, homeless misery of millions of people around the planet, I get angry and I feel the need to do something about correcting the wrongs I see. I have discovered that it is a whisper from the soul that stirs me. A silent surge of emotion creates a tear or makes me angry enough to swear at the television news commentator or videotape sound bites by G.W. Bush or Tom DeLay or Bill Frist or John Kerry, Joe Lieberman, virtually every American politician. I think radicals are born, not made. I think a radical has always been a radical in his worldview. He or she cannot accept things that aren't just or are hurtful to humanity or other inhabitants on the planet. Some radicals are violent. The most famous and most effective radicals are nonviolent. I believe many people are born radicals. They are the men, women, and children who refuse to bend to the will of nature or suffer the indignity of physical or mental abuse and demand just retribution. A radical is anyone who will courageously fight back against anyone or anything they determine is a wrong against them or others. As a radical, I weigh my options and interests and willingness before I take action. Will I go to the courts? Will I write letters to a company's president or to government officials? Will I storm the Capitol building? I'm still trying to decide how radically radical I really am. I think I am like others who are waiting for their soul's whisper to turn into a shout or a scream until we can no longer sit still or remain silent as the scale of justice is breaking under the weight of injustice. The following paragraph is a quote. If the injustice has a spring or a pulley or a rope or a crank exclusively for itself, then perhaps you may consider whether the remedy will not be worse than the evil. But if it is of such a nature that it requires you to be the agent of injustice to another, then I say break the law. Let your life be counter-friction to stop the machine. What I have to do is to see, at any rate, that I do not lend myself to the wrong which I condemn. That was by Henry David Thoreau, Civil Disobedience. That was a great essay, Essay of Civil Disobedience. It inspired many, many leaders. If I can, and if you will let me, I wanted to try to read this tonight, if I have enough time. I wanted to read Civil Disobedience to you. It's not a very long essay, but On the Duty of Civil Disobedience by Henry David Thoreau. And he wrote this in 1849, and his original title was Resistance to Civil Government. I heartily accept the motto that government is best when governs least. And I should like to see it acted up to more rapidly and systematically. carried out, it finally amounts to this. And also, I believe that government is best which governs not at all. And when men are prepared for it, that will be the kind of government which the will have. Government is at best but an expedient, but most governments are usually, and all governments are sometimes, inexpedient. The objections which have been brought against the standing army, and they are many and weighty and deserve to prevail, may also at last be brought against the standing government. The standing army is only an arm of the standing government. The government itself, which is only the mode which the people have chosen to execute their will, is equally liable to be abused and perverted before the people can act through it. Witness the Mexican War, the work of comparatively a few individuals using the standing government as their tool. For the outset, the people would not have consented to this measure. This American government, what is it but a tradition, though a recent one, endeavoring to transmit itself unprepared to prosperity, but yet instant losing some of its integrity. It has not the vitality and force of a single living man, for a single man can bend it to his will. It is a source of wooden gun to the people themselves, but it is not the less necessary for this, for the people must have some complicated machinery or other, and hear its din to satisfy the idea of government which they have. Governments show us how successfully men can be imposed upon, even imposed on themselves for their own advantage. It is excellent, we must all allow. This is government never of itself further any enterprise, but by the alacrity in which it got out of its way. It does not keep the country free. It does not settle the West. It does not educate. The character inherent in the American people has done all that, has been accomplished, and it would have done somewhat more the government had not sometimes gotten its way. For government is an expedient by which men would fain succeed in letting one another alone. And as has been said, when it is most expedient, the government has most let alone by it. Trade and commerce, if they were not made of India rubber, would never manage to bounce over obstacles which legislators are continually putting in their way. And if one were to judge these men wholly by the effects of their actions and not partly by their intentions, they would deserve to be classed and punished with those mischievous persons who put obstructions on the railroads. But to speak practically and as a citizen, unlike those who call themselves no government men, I ask for not at one no government, but at once a better government. Let every man make known what kind of government would command his respect, and that will be one step toward obtaining it. After all, the practical reason why, when the power is won in the hands of the people, the majority are permitted, and for a long period continue to rule, is not because they are most likely to be in the right, nor because they see it seems fairest to the minority, but because they are physically the strongest. But a government in which the majority rule, in all cases, cannot be based on justice, even as far as men understand it. Can there not be a government in which the majorities do not virtually decide right and wrong, but conscience? In which majorities decide only those questions to which the rule of expediency is applicable? Must the citizen ever for a moment, or in the least degree, resign his conscience to the legislator? Why has every man a conscience, then? I think that we should be men first, and subjects afterward. It is not desirable to cultivate respect for the law, so much as for the right. The only obligation which I have a right to assume is to do at any time what I think right. It is truly enough said that a corporation has no conscience, but a corporation unconscious men is a corporation with a conscience. Law never made men a whit more just, and by means of their respect for it, even the well-disposed are daily made the agents on injustice. A common and natural result of an undue respect of the law is that you may see a file of soldiers, colonels, colonel, captain, corporal, privates, powder monkeys, and all marching in admirable order over hill and dale to the wars against their will, aye, against their common sense and consciences, which makes it very steep marching indeed, and produces a palpitation of the heart. They have no doubt that it is a damnable business in which they are concerned, and they are all peaceably inclined. Now, what are they? Men at all? Or small, movable forts and magazines at the service of some unscrupulous man in power? Visit the Navy Yard and behold a Marine, such a man as an American government can make, or such as it can make a man with its black art, a mere shadow and reminiscence of humanity, a man laid out alive and standing and already, as one may say, buried under arms with funeral accompaniment. True though it may be, not a drum was heard, not a funeral note, as his course to the rampart he hurried, not a soldier discharged his farewell shot, or the grave where our hero was buried. The mass of men serve the status thus, not as men mainly, but as machines with their bodies. They are the standing army and the militia, jailers, constables, posse comitatus, etc. In most cases, there is no free exercise whatever of the judgment of the moral sense, but they put themselves on a level, and wood and earth and stone and wooden men can perhaps be manufactured that will serve the purpose as well. Such command no more respect than men of straw or a lump of dirt. They have the same sort of worth only as horses and dogs. Yet such as these even as commonly esteemed good citizens, others as most legislators, politicians, lawyers, ministers, and office holders serve the state chiefly with their heads, and as the rarely make any moral distinction, they are as likely to be served to serve the devil without intending it as God. A very few as heroes, patriots, martyrs, reformers of this great necessarily resist it for the most part, and they are commonly treated as enemies by it. A wise man will only be useful as a man and will not submit to be clay and stop a hole to keep the wind away, but leave that office to his dust at least. I am too high born to be propertied, to be a second at control, or useful serving man and instrument to any sovereign state throughout the world. He who gives himself entirely to his fellow man appears to them useless and selfish, but he who gives himself partially to them and pronounced a benefactor and philanthropist. How does it become a man to behave toward the American government today? I answer that he cannot without disgrace be associated with it. I cannot for an instant recognize the political organization as my government, which is the slave's government also. All men recognize the right of revolution, that is, the right to refuse allegiance to and to resist the government when its tyranny or its inefficiency are great and unendurable. But also, all say that such is not the case now. But such was the case, that they think, in the Revolution of 75. If one were to tell me that this was a bad government because it taxed certain foreign commodities brought to its ports, it is most probable that I should not make an ado about it, for I can do without them. All machines have their friction, and possibly this does an enough good to counterbalance the evil. At any rate, it is a great evil to make a stir about it. But when the friction becomes to have its machine, and oppression and robbery are organized, I say let us not have such a machine any longer. In other words, when a sixth of the population of a nation, which has undertaken to be the refuge of liberty, are slaves, and a whole country is unjustly overrun and conquered by a foreign army and subjected to military law, I think that it is not too soon for honest men to rebel and revolutionize. What makes this duty the more urgent is that the fact that this country, so overrun, is not our own, but ours is the invading army. Paley, a common authority with many or on moral questions, in his chapter on the duty of submission to civil government, resolves all civil obligation into expediency, and he proceeds to say that so long as the interest of the whole society requires it, that it, so long as the establishment government cannot be resisted or changed without public inconveniency, it is the will of God that the established government be obeyed and no longer. This principle being admitted, the justice of every particular case of resistance is reduced to a computation of the quantity of the danger and grievance of the one side and of the probability and expense of redressing it on the other. Of this we say, every man shall judge for himself. But Paley appears never to have contemplated those cases to which the rule of expediency does not apply, in which a people as well as an individual must do justice, cost what it may. If I have unjustly wrested a plank from a drowning man, I must restore it to him, though I drown myself. This, according to Paley, would be inconvenient, but he that would save his life in such a case shall lose it. This people must cease to hold slaves and to make war on Mexico, though it cost them their existence as a people. In their practice, nations agree with Paley. But does anyone think that Massachusetts does exactly what is right at the present crisis? Massachusetts was where Henry David Thoreau lived. A drab of stat, a cloth of silver slut, to have her train borne up and her soul trail in the dirt. Practically speaking, the opponents to a reform in Massachusetts are not 100,000 politicians at the South, but 100,000 merchants and farmers here who are more interested in commerce and agriculture than they are in humanity and are not prepared to do justice to the slave and to Mexico, cost what it may. A quarrel not with far-off foes, but with those who meet at home, cooperate with, and do the bidding of those far away, and without whom the latter would be harmless. We are accustomed to say that the mass of men are unprepared, but improvement is slow because the few are not as materially wise or better than the many. It is not so important that many should be good as you, as that there be some absolute goodness somewhere, for that will leaven the whole lump. And there are thousands who are in opinion opposed to slavery and to war, who yet in effect do nothing to put an end to them, who esteeming themselves children of Washington and Franklin, sit down with their hands in their pockets and say that they know not what to do and do nothing, who even postpone the question of freedom to the question of free trade, and who quietly read the prices current along with the latest advices from Mexico while dinner and it may be fall asleep over both of them. What is the price current of an honest man and patriot today? They hesitate and they regret and sometimes they petition, but they do nothing in earnest with effect. They will wait, well disposed, for others to remedy the evil, that they may no longer have to regret. At most, they give up only a cheap vote and a feeble countenance, Godspeed to the right as it goes by them. There are 999 patrons of virtue to one virtuous man. But it is easier to deal with the real possessor of a thing than with the temporary guardian of it. All voting is a sort of gaming, like checkers or backgammon, with a slight moral tinge to it. A playing with right and wrong, with moral questions and betting naturally accompanies it. The characters of the voters is not staked. I cast my vote, perchance, as I think right, but I am not vitally concerned that that right should prevail. I am willing to leave it to the majority. Its obligation, therefore, never exceeds that of expediency. Even voting for the right is not doing nothing for it. It is only expressing to men feebly your desire that it should prevail. A wise man will not leave the right to the mercy of chance, nor will it to prevail through the power of the majority. There is but little virtue in the action of masses of men. When the majority shall at length vote for the abolition of slavery, it will be because they are indifferent to slavery, or because they are but little slavery left to be abolished by their vote. They will then be the only slaves. Only his vote can hasten the abolition of slavery, who asserts his own freedom by his vote. I hear of a convention to be held at Baltimore or elsewhere for the selection of a candidate for the presidency, made up chiefly of editors and men who are politicians by profession. But I think, what is it to any independent, intelligent, and respectable man what decision they may come to? Shall we not have the advantage of this wisdom and honesty, nevertheless? Can we not count upon some independent votes? Are there not many individuals in the country who would not attend conventions? But no, I find that the respectable man, to so-called, has immediately drifted from his position and despairs of his country, when his country has more reasons to despair of him. He forthwith adopts one of the candidates thus selected as the only available one, thus proving that he is himself available for any purposes of a demagogue. His vote is of no more worth than that of an unprincipled foreigner or hireling native who may have been bought. Oh, for a man who is a man, and my neighbor says, has a bone in his back which you cannot pass your hand through. Our statistics are at fault. The population has been returned too large. How many men are there to square a thousand miles in the country? Hardly one. Does not America offer an inducement for men to settle here? The American has dwindled into an odd fellow, one who may be known by the development of his organ of gregariousness and manifest lack of intellect and cheerful self-reliance, whose first and chief concern on coming into the world is to see that the almshouses are in good repair, and before yet he has lawfully donned the viral garb to collect a fund to the support of the widows and the orphans, it may be, who in short ventured to live only by the aid of the mutual insurance company, which has promised to bury him decently. It is not a man's duty, as a matter of course, to devote himself to the eradication of any, even to most enormous wrong. He may still properly have other concerns to engage him, but it is his duty, at least to wash his hands of it. And if he gives it no thought longer, nor to give it practically his support, if I devote myself to other pursuits and contemplations, I must first see at least that I do not pursue them sitting upon another man's shoulders. I must get off him first, that he may pursue his contemplations too. See what gross inconsistency is tolerated, I have heard some of my townsmen say. I should like to have them order me out to help put down an insurrection of the slaves, or can march to Mexico. See if I would go. And yet, these very men have each directed directly by their allegiance, and so indirectly at least by their money, furnished a substitute. The soldier is applauded who refuses to serve as an unjust war by those who do not refuse to sustain the unjust government which makes the war. Is applauded by those who own, act, and authority he disregards and sets at naught, as if the state were penitent to that degree that it hired one to scourge it while it sinned, but not to that degree that it left off sinning for a moment. Thus, under the name of order and civil government, we are all made at last to pay homage to and support our own meanness. After the first blush of sin comes its indifference, and from immoral it becomes, as it were, unmoral, and not quite necessary to that life which we have made. The broadest and most prevalent error requires the most disinterested virtue to sustain it. The slight reproach to which the virtue of patriotism is commonly liable, the noble are most likely to incur. Those who, while they disapprove of the character and measures of government, yield to it their allegiance and support, while undoubtedly its most conscientious supporters, and so frequently the most serious obstacle to reform. Some are petitioning the state to dissolve the Union, to disregard the requisitions of the President. Why do they not dissolve it themselves, the Union between themselves and the state, and refuse to pay their quota into its treasury? Do not they stand in same relation to the state that the state does to the Union? And have not the same reasons prevented the state from resisting the Union, which have prevented them from resisting the state? How can a man be satisfied to entertain the opinion merely and enjoy it? Is there any enjoyment in it if his opinion is that he is aggrieved? If you are cheated out of a single dollar by your neighbor, you do not rest satisfied with knowing you are cheated, or with saying that you are cheated, or even with petitioning him to pay you your due. But you take effectual steps at once to obtain the full amount, and see to it that you are never cheated again. Action from principle, the perception and performance of right, changes things and relations. It is essentially revolutionary, and does not consist wholly with anything which was. It not only divided states and churches, it divides families. It divides the individual, separating the diabolical in him from the divine. Unjust laws exist. Shall we be content to obey them, or shall we endeavor to amend them and obey them until we have succeeded, or shall we transgress them at once? Men generally under such a government as this think that they ought to wait until they have persuaded the majority to alter them. They think that if they should resist, the remedy would be worse than the evil. But it is the fault of the government itself that the remedy is worse than the evil. It makes it worse. Why is it not more apt to anticipate and provide for reform? Why does it not cherish the wise minority? Why does it cry and resist before it is hurt? Why does it not encourage its citizens to put out its faults and do better than it would have them? Why does it always crucify Christ and excommunicate Copernicus and Luther and pronounce Washington and Franklin rebels? One would think that a deliberate and practical denial of its authority was the only offense never contemplated by its government. Else, why has it not assigned its definite, its suitable and proportionate penalty? If a man who has no property refuses but wants to earn 9 shillings for the state, he is put in prison for a period limited to any law that I know, and determined only by the discretion of those who put him there. But if he should steal 90 times 9 shillings from the state, he is soon permitted to go at large again. If the injustice is part of the necessary friction of the machine of government, let it go. Let it go. Perchance it will wear smooth. Certainly the machine will wear out. If the injustice has a spring or a pulley or a rope or a crank exclusively for itself, then perhaps you may consider whether the remedy will be worse than the evil. But if it is of such a nature that it requires you to be the agent of injustice to another, then I say break the law. Let your life be counter-friction to the machine. What I have to do is to see, at any rate, that I do not lend myself to the wrong which I condemn. As for adopting the ways of the state has provided for remedying the evil, I know not of such ways. They make too much time, and a man's life would be gone. I have other affairs to attend to. I came into this world not chiefly to make this a good place to live in, but to live in it, be it good or bad. A man has not everything to do, but something, and because he cannot do everything, it is not necessary that he should be petitioning the governor or the legislature any more than it is theirs to petition me. And if they should not hear my petition, what should I do then? But in the case that the state has provided no way, its very constitution is the evil. This may seem to be harsh and stubborn and inconciliatory, but it is to treat with the most kindness and consideration the only spirit that can appreciate or deserves it. So is my change for the better like birth and death which convulse the body? I do not hesitate to say that those who call themselves abolitionists should at once effectually withdraw the support both in person and property from the government of Massachusetts, and not wait until they constitute a majority of one before they suffer the right to prevail through them. I think that it is enough to have God on their side without waiting for that other one. Moreover, any man more right than his neighbors constitutes a majority of one already. I meet this American government or its representative, the state government, directly and face to face once a year, no more in the person of its tax gatherer. This is the only mode in which a man situated as I am necessarily meets it, and then says it distinctly, recognizes me, and the simplest, the most effectual, and in the present posture of affairs, the indispensablest mode of treating with it on his head, of expressing your little satisfaction with and love for it, is to deny it then. My civil neighbor, the tax gatherer, is the very man I have to deal with, for it is, after all, with men and not with parchment that I quarrel, and he has voluntarily chosen to be an agent of the government. How shall he ever know well that he is and does as an officer of the government or as a man until he is obliged to consider whether he will treat me, his neighbor, for whom he has respect, as a neighbor and well-disposed man, or as a maniac and disturber of the peace, and see if he can get over the obstruction to his neighbor lines without a ruder and more impetuous thought or speech and corresponding with his action. I know this well, that I 1,000, if 1,000, if one, I know this well, that if 1,000, if 100, if 10 men whom I could name, if 10 honest men only, I, if one honest man in his state of slavery, in his state, rather, of Massachusetts, ceasing to hold slaves, were actually to withdraw from his co-partnership and be locked up in the country jail, therefore, it would be the abolition of slavery in America. For it matters not how small the beginning may seem to be. What is once well done is done forever. But we love better to talk about it. To talk about it. That we say it is our mission. Reform seems many scores of newspapers and its service, but not one man. If my esteemed neighbor, the state senator, who will devote his days to the settlement of the question of human rights in the council chamber, instead of being threatened with the prisons of Carolina, were to sit down the prisoner of Massachusetts, that state which is so anxious to foist the sin of slavery upon her sister, though at present she can discover only an act of inhospitality to be the grounds of quarrel with her, the legislature would not wholly waive the subject of the following winter. Under the government which imprisons unjustly, the true place for a just man is also prison. The proper place today, the only place which Massachusetts has provided for her freer and less despondent spirits, is her prisons, to be put out and locked out of the state by her own act, as they have already put themselves out by their principles. It is there that the fugitive slave and the Mexican prisoner on parole and the Indian come to plead the wrongs of his race should find them. On that separate but more free and honorable ground where the state places those who are not with her, but against her. Excuse me. The only house in a slave state in which a free man can abide with honor. This is jail. If any think that their influence would be lost there and their voices no longer afflict the ear of the state, that they would not be as an enemy within its walls, they do not know by how much truth is stronger than error, nor how much more eloquently and effectively he can combat injustice who has experienced a little in his own person. Cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence. A minority is just men in prison. A minority is powerless while it conforms to the majority. It is not even a minority then, but it is irresistible when it clogs by its whole weight. If the alternative is to keep all just men in prison, or give up war and slavery, the state will not hesitate which to choose. If 1,000 men were to not pay their tax bill this year, that would not be violent and bloody measure, as it would be to pay them and enable the state to commit violence and shed blood, innocent blood. This is, in fact, the definition of peaceable revolution, if any such is possible. But the tax gatherer or any other public officer asks me, as one has done, but what shall I do? My answer is, if you really wish to do anything, resign your office. When the subject has refused allegiance and the officer has resigned from office, then the revolution is accomplished. But even suppose bloodshed when the conscience is wounded. Through this wound, a man's real manhood and immortality flow out, and he bleeds to his everlasting death. I see this blood flowing now. I have contemplated the imprisonment of the offender rather than the seizure of his goods, though both will serve the same purpose, because they who assert the purest right, consequently, in comparatively small service, as a slight tax, is wont to appear exorbitant, particularly if they are obliged to earn it by special labor with their hands. Unfortunately, this is a little bit longer than I thought it was going to be. And I'm not going to finish it tonight. And I may pick this up next week. But in the 4 minutes I have remaining, I want to... I just want to say that as we enter this time, of revolution in the Middle East and uprisings around the country and even our country, although right now we're being oppressed by weather, there is a revolution going on here, a political revolution of the Tea Parties, the people who disagree with our government and they're forming other governments, but they're being manipulated, and the manipulation is so apparent by the Koch brothers who have formed these groups and paid billions, have billions of dollars, but have paid millions of dollars to the Sarah Palins and the Fox Newses and the Tea Party members and the people who were elected into the Tea Party, by the Tea Party, and the Republican Party. It's all time now. In the Civil Disobedience, written by Henry David Thoreau, is an immortal work and has lasted 150, 60 years in the American literature and in American philosophy. And yet, people still do not recognize the power that they have as one and as a group and as a minority. All minorities, any minority has great power as long as they resist the majority and demand their rights. And that's exactly what you're seeing in Egypt now, around the Middle East, and they're sick of the United States' oppression, unfortunately, and the oppression of the dictators who rule those countries. And and they're practicing what we should be practicing, which is that, you know, what Henry David Thoreau is doing is stating in Civil Disobedience. We must practice civil disobedience. You know, nonviolent, preferably, but nevertheless, if we see a wrong in our government and in our world, we must stand up against it, because it will soon become a wrong against us. And if no one stands up to it, it's all over. So I want to thank you all for listening tonight. We only got about 5 seconds left, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Join us tomorrow when we have George Dixon. Good night.
Congratulations. Congratulations. You won.
Thank you.
February 12th and the XL Center February 26th. Oh, I see. A throne for the TV. Room for movies. Your workout gear. Nonstop football. It's a man cave. The boys next door will never leave. Okay, you know what?
Just in case, can't hurt, right? Yeah. not going to hand out a rose, but one knock could change all that. ABC's The Bachelor, all new Monday at 8, 7 Central on ABC.
Welcome to the Sunshine Center. We've got rock concerts, the circus, lingerie football. 18,000 people fill this place every night, and I'm in charge of the whole thing. What could possibly go wrong?
She's going anywhere.
Wanda Allison's blood pressure was slightly elevated, but I would recommend you go get down. It's fine. It's a real problem.
And we'll end with year two.
Charts are updated. Decide who's going to be current sis?
Why would I decide now? Patient care has never been better. I mean, once I choose one of you, it's just going to be skulking around like a surly teenager.
Okay, this should be an easy choice. I have been practicing these grass attachments every day for a month.
Some of us don't need to practice.
Sure, yeah. You've got more experience overall. But the last couple months, you haven't exactly logged a lot of hours in the OR, have you?
You really have to go there? You're that insecure?
No. Just that much of an idiot. Don't have it.
Can I help you with something, Richie? I'm trying to look at baby teens on the internet. I think you mean tweets, sir. Whatever. No, no, not whatever. It's important you get that one right. No, let me try. Baby's putting their searches on the internet all over. So I'm looking into it. I think it's a terrible idea. But maybe a good way to reach students. It might be Bailey bragging to the world about Bailey. This thing isn't designed for medicine. It's designed for gossip. Now, the GPS is designed for the U.S. military to keep an eye on foreign troop movements. Now, in everyone's car, you know, you go out, never have to get lost again. I don't go out. So the conversation for next time. There you go. Bailey's Twitter page. Looks like she's tweeting the surgery right now. What?
So that's why we also have to do a left hemicolectomy.
Here's a question from...
Dr. Bailey, I specifically told you not to tweet your surgeries until I looked into it.
I'm sorry, Chief. I misunderstood. I thought you said I could tweet until you decided.
Don't play dumb. That's not what I said, and you know it. Put away that little toy.
Oh, she's hemorrhaging. Come on, tell me something. I don't know what's
okay,
going
hold on. Let's see. Yeah, because we've got a pseudo aneurysm in the splenic artery.
What happened?
Pancreatic enzymes are leaking into the abdomen. They're dissolving the blood vessels. Clamp.
I'm
already on it. Clamp.
When you realize that depression has left you nowhere to go, when you've lost interest in everything, when you've had one too many days feeling sad or anxious, aches and pains, fatigue, when it becomes hard to ignore that you need help, that's the day you do something. Depression hurts. Cymbalta, get help with many symptoms of depression. Tell your doctor right away if your depression worsens, you have unusual changes in behavior, or thoughts of suicide. Antidepressants can increase these in children, teens, and young adults. Cymbalta is not approved for children under 18. People taking MAOIs or thyroidine or with uncontrolled glaucoma should not take Cymbalta. Taking it with NSAID pain relievers, aspirin, or blood thinners may increase bleeding risk. Problems, some fatal, were reported. Signs include abdominal pain and yellowing of the skin or eyes. Talk with your doctor about your medicines, including those for migraine, or if you have high fever, confusion, and stiff muscles, to address a possible life-threatening condition. Tell your doctor about alcohol use, liver disease, and before you reduce or stop taking Cymbalta. Dizziness or fainting may occur upon standing. Side effects include nausea, dry mouth, and constipation. Is today your day? Talk to your doctor. And go to Cymbalta.com for a free 30-capsule trial offer. Depression hurts. Cymbalta can help.
So is that one of them smarty phones?
Yes. I got it at the shack. The smarty phone experts.
You're mocking me, aren't you?
With the best phones, the right plans, and the knowledge to help you find your perfect fit, the shack helps you get mobile.
Finally, there's a new choice in high-performance detergent. Introducing Whisk with Stain Spectrum Technology. Try new Whisk. We upgraded the formula, but not the price.
Hybrid holds a 10 miles per gallon advantage in the city over the Toyota Camry hybrid.
That's
Deep Set Wrinkle Repair by L'Oreal.
All new EBC Monday. Life in the fast lane. Whoa. Takes a wrong turn. For one unlucky $1 million lottery winner.
Sounds like dead people.
A colorful castle case.
Either that guy who really likes Avatar.
He's our killer.
With a cast of characters and a novel twist.
The butler is doing
it. Or did he?
No.
Come on.
ABC's Castle. All new Monday at 10, 9 central on ABC.
The newest member of Storm Team 8 is meteorologist Steve McLaughlin. I am so excited to be here. I'm excited to serve the viewers of Connecticut, and I'm really excited to work with Dr. Mel. I've spent time with this guy. I've seen him work, and I have to tell you, he's got it. Dr. Mel is a legend. I mean, he wrote a book on Connecticut weather. To have his approval really means a lot. Steve McLaughlin, only on News 8.
I get everything the way I want. Not because I'm a huge celebrity, which I am, but because I have Xfinity. I watch my favorites on demand and online. Anywhere I want.
You're the remote couch. Xfinity has the world's greatest collection of on demand, on TV and online. Satellite can't match that. Switch to Xfinity for $99 a month for 12 months and we'll guarantee a rate for 2 years. Plus, get 3 months of HBO free. Or step up to an HD triple play and get up to $200 back. Call 1-800-XFINITY today.
It's scary. The deficit that we have in this state is very scary.
I would focus on the spending side and cut as much as possible.
Or cut spending. Cut government spending.
Cut spending. I think we pay way too much taxes as it is.
Cut spending what you can. You raise taxes anymore. I don't know if I'll be able to keep my house or not.
You just cut back on spending? You can't spend what you don't have.
All of us have had to pull in our belts, so to speak.
Clearly, the answer is reduce spending.
All families in Connecticut have to live within their means, and so should the state of Connecticut.
Anyone see any more bleeding?
No, but what's left of the pancreas is still leaking.
We need to take out that whole thing.
It's one thing to live with half the pancreas.
Let's remove the whole thing.
These lives are going to be hell.
Great, put that damn thing away.
Both of you, they suggest an islet cell auto transplant?
That's with pancreatitis. You don't do it with trauma fish.
What is it exactly?
You isolate the cells from the pancreas and inject them into the liver. They trick the liver into acting like a pancreas and making insulin.
Yeah, when it works, you need an awful lot of cells.
You know, just because it isn't done for trauma.
I know, but even if we wanted to, we don't have the equipment to extract cells. We need a recording chamber.
We don't have it, but Northwestern does.
Find it out.
They can get it on a plane and have you put in here in 6 hours.
It's too late. He's too late.
Okay. Hold on. Denver, Tacoma Method. Yes, they've got it.
We take out the pancreas. I get on the helicopter to Tacoma with it. I'm back in 90 minutes. You manage in the meantime.
Transplantation in a trauma patient, but we're not treating.
pancreas is usually too damaged to take it off cells.
From a PC at home, like a
back to life. Get yours at AT&T.
I'm going to call Victoria and get her here as soon as I can.
When you are tweeting tomorrow, tell everybody.
Moving back in.